Please turn in your Bibles to 2 Chronicles chapter 25. We are slowly making progress, a chapter a week. And today we come to King Amaziah, who was the son of Joash or Jehoash. So please listen as I read 2 Chronicles chapter 25. Amaziah was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Jehoahadan of Jerusalem. And he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, but not with a loyal heart. Now it happened, as soon as the kingdom was established for him, that he executed his servants who had murdered his father the king. However, he did not execute their children, but did as it is written in the law of in the book of Moses, where the Lord commanded, saying, "The fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall the children be put to death for their fathers, but a person shall die for his own sin." Moreover, Amaziah gathered Judah together and set over them captains of thousands and captains of hundreds, according to their fathers' houses, throughout all Judah and Benjamin. And he numbered them from 20 years old and above, and found them to be 300,000 choice men, able to go to war, who could handle spear and shield. He also hired 100,000 mighty men of valor from Israel for 100 talents of silver. But a man of God came to him, saying, "O king, do not let the army of Israel go with you, for the Lord is not with Israel, not with any of the children of Ephraim. But if you go, be gone, be strong in battle. Even so, God shall make you fall before the enemy, for God has power to help and to overthrow." Then Amaziah said to the man of God, "But what shall we do about the 100 talents which I have given to the troops of Israel?" And the man of God answered, "The Lord is able to give you much more than this." So Amaziah discharged the troops that had come to him from Ephraim to go back home. Therefore their anger was greatly aroused against Judah, and they returned home in great anger. Then Amaziah strengthened himself, and leading his people, he went to the Valley of Salt and killed 10,000 of the people of Seir. Now also the children of Judah took captive 10,000 alive, brought them to the top of the rock, and cast them down from the top of the rock, so that they all were dashed in pieces. But as for the soldiers of the army which Amaziah had discharged, so that they would not go with him to battle, they raided the cities of Judah from Samaria to Beth Horon, killed 3,000 of them, and took much spoil. Now it was so, after Amaziah came from the slaughter of the Edomites, that he brought the gods of the people of Seir, set them up to be his gods, and bowed down before them and burned incense to them. Therefore the anger of the Lord was aroused against Amaziah, and he sent him a prophet who said to him, "Why have you sought the gods of the people which could not rescue their own people from your hand?" So it was, as he talked with them, that the king said to him, "If we made you the king's counselor, cease. Why should you be killed?" And the prophet ceased and said, "I know that God has determined to destroy you, because you have done this and have not heeded my advice." Now Amaziah, king of Judah, asked advice and sent to Joash, the son of Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, king of Israel, saying, "Come, let us face one another in battle." And Joash, king of Israel, sent to Amaziah, king of Judah, saying, "The thistle that was in Lebanon sent to the cedar that was in Lebanon, saying, 'Give your daughter to my son as wife.' And a wild beast that was in Lebanon passed by and trampled the thistle. Indeed, you say that you have defeated the Edomites, and your heart is lifted up to boast. Stay at home now. Why should you meddle with trouble, that you should fall, you and Judah with you?" But Amaziah would not heed, for it came from God, that he might give them into the hand of their enemies, because they sought the gods of Edom. So Joash, king of Israel, went out, and he and Amaziah, king of Judah, faced one another at Beth Shemesh, which belongs to Judah. And Judah was defeated by Israel, and every man fled to his tent. Then Joash, the king of Israel, captured Amaziah, king of Judah, the son of Joash, the son of Jehoahaz, at Beth Shemesh. And he brought him to Jerusalem, and broke down the wall of Jerusalem from the gate of Ephraim to the corner gate, 400 cubits. And he took all the gold and silver, all the articles that were found in the house of God with Obed-Edom, the treasures of the king's house, and hostages, and returned to Samaria. Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, lived 15 years after the death of Joash, the son of Jehoahaz, king of Israel. Now the rest of the acts of Amaziah, from first to last, indeed, are they not written in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel? After the time that Amaziah turned away from following the Lord, they made a conspiracy against him in Jerusalem, and he fled to Lachish. But they sent after him to Lachish and killed him there. And they brought him on horses and buried him with his fathers in the city of Judah. Now you remember the man we're talking about here, Amaziah, is the son of Joash or Jehoash, who was the one rescued from the rage of Athaliah in her attempt to stamp out the royal seed, and who had ruled while Jehoiada, his faithful advisor, was alive, had ruled faithfully, but turned to be unfaithful in the latter part of his life. This is his son. Remember, Jehoash had been killed, had been assassinated, and that's referred to at the beginning of the chapter here. The assessment of Amaziah is given in verse 2 of 2 Chronicles 25, and he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, but not with a loyal heart. That idea of loyalty or sincerity of heart is a very important one in the book of Chronicles, and it, I suppose, would correspond in the New Testament to Christ's references to the singleness of heart, the one who has a single heart, a devoted attitude, the one who is focused on the things of the kingdom of God. That's not the way he was. He did what was right, but not with a loyal or a faithful or sincere heart, not wholeheartedly. Now, I thought it would be helpful to compare that statement with the assessment given in 2 Kings. The parallel passage here is in 2 Kings 14. 2 Kings 14, verse 3, gives the assessment for the same man. And he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, yet not like his father David. He did everything as his father Joash had done. So there's the comparison. He did just what his father had done. And you can, in fact, see through the chapter that same sort of transition from a relative faithfulness, although there's not anything like the description of the faithfulness of his father, to a complete abandonment and to his own destruction, even down to the point of his assassination, the way his father had been assassinated. So I thought that was a telling comparison. He did just as his father had done. In that case, that wouldn't be a hopeful sign. It would be a sign of, again, a sort of a mixed attitude, not completely abandoning himself to wickedness throughout his life, but that half-hearted devotion, which in the end led to really the overthrow of everything he worked for. The other point of introduction I would make is just to remind you that there's overlap between the names of the kings. And so if you're confused how it is that Amaziah could challenge his own father, who was dead, to battle, you'll have to remember from our handy table that at that time the king of the northern kingdom was Jehoash, or Joash. Okay, so the names were used across the borders, and there's, if you don't kind of keep track of who's who, then it looks a little confusing. But the fellow he challenges is the king of the northern kingdom, who has the same name as his father had. Sometimes it's given as Joash, sometimes as Jehoash. But that's the context there. Well, with that bit of an introduction, I'd like to look at some of the details of his life. We see the outplay of the unfaithfulness and how even the good things he accomplished in the end are ruined by that. Yeah.
With the comment about the king, the common names, is that the reason why in verse 17 the small genealogy is given about who is the son of whom to differentiate?
It could well be, yeah. Yeah.
Just trying to offer further clarification that you're following.
It could be. Yeah, there's something something of the pedigree of this fellow. He didn't descend from Ahab, which was the guy in the northern kingdom. And so that would be in his favor. He was the grandson, I guess it would be, of Jehu, who started out at least with zeal. But probably it would help help us keep track of things. Especially in the case of Chronicles, where he's not laying out what's going on in the northern kingdom. In Kings, it's a little bit easier because you've already heard about this guy, probably. At least we'll hear about him later. But yeah, that's right. Any other comments? Okay. Well, the beginning of his reign is after this description of the overall assessment is in verse 3. It says, as soon as the kingdom was established for him, that he executed his servants who had murdered his father, the king. Now that idea of having the kingdom established is, again, a recurring theme. It's when a new king comes to power, he has to make sure that he really has come to power and has to put down any opposition or any other contenders for the throne. But what he does here is execute those who have assassinated his father. What he does not do is given in verse 4, and that is that he did not execute their children. And it says, but did as it is written in the book of the law of Moses. Now that's a reference there, a quotation of Deuteronomy 24:16, and the law that's given there is precisely this idea that if a man is guilty of a crime, then the man is to be executed, but not his children. Now, what was common practice in the ancient Near East was that you would not only kill those who killed, in this case, your father, but you would also kill all the descendants. After all, they could threaten your power, right? These were the people who were opposed to your rule. And besides, you know, might as well just get even and kill them all. But it's a very, in a sense, this is a very positive statement about what he did, because it's a restraint of power, which he probably could have executed these people, and probably could be leaving himself open to having trouble. But he restrains himself and doesn't do it. Now, let me just make a sort of a footnote here. There is a biblical principle of the unity of the family, and I guess sometimes it's called the integrity, that is the connection between the father and the son, or the children in general, is of course a common theme, not only in the Old but also in the New Testament. And there are cases when God judges men and their children as well, and even references to that in the Ten Commandments, that God will visit his wrath to the third and fourth generation. The distinction is what is it, the distinguishing question is, what right does the civil magistrate have? Does he have the right to execute that sort of a judgment? And the answer, the general principle, is no, he doesn't. So you see the distinction that's made. God certainly has the right to visit the iniquities of the fathers and the children. If nothing else, the children are complicit in their own guilt in Adam and their own sinfulness. That's a really complete different issue, completely different issue to go into. I just want to point out this is not contradicting it. It's talking in the narrow realm of what it is the civil ruler has the right to do, and he doesn't have the right to act in the way to wipe out basically the line of those who assassinated his father. Any questions about that? Makes sense. It'd be interesting to discuss the larger principle. Sorry. I was traveling over the weekend, strange schedule, my voice may not work very well. But even though that general issue is an interesting one here, I think it's fairly clear-cut what he's doing. And then verse 5 turns to the military campaign. He's going up against Edom ultimately, and this is really an introduction to that. Edom, you remember, had been subject to the rule of Judah, and then they rebelled and sort of went back and forth, and we've seen glimpses of that as we've gone through Chronicles. But the first thing he does is muster the troops, at least in the sense of getting an idea of how large a force he has. And so you see the total given there at the end of verse 5 is 300,000 choice men. Now that's fairly impressive until you compare it with the force that Jehoshaphat had, for example. And I put the reference up in 2 Chronicles 17, verses 14 through 19. But there the sum isn't given, just the individual counts under different leaders. But if you add up the numbers that are given there, Jehoshaphat had something like three or four times as many men to fight with. And the chronicler doesn't bring this out explicitly, but I think probably implicit is the idea that the unfaithfulness of his fathers had weakened the nation. Matthew Henry just has the pithy statement, which he's known for, sin weakens a people. And that, I think that's the underlying theme here, although it's not brought out explicitly. He has enough men to fight, and even though he does, it's still relatively small to the greater days. Now, we've discussed before that large or small, in a sense, doesn't matter. The last chapter, his father's army was overthrown. by a much smaller host than his. And the point is made there that God wanted to demonstrate his own power. But the count that's given here is, I think, small relative to the greater days. And then the focus turns in verse 6 to these mercenaries. So these are soldiers from Israel, from the northern kingdom, who are hired to fight. And it says the price was 100 talents of silver. This is an example of one of these stories in Chronicles that you can sort of pluck out of the context and just think about on its own. And lots of sayings in Chronicles are just things worth meditating on, even in a sense neglecting the larger context. And this little account has a saying like that. But he's hired these mercenaries. He's ready to go. And, you know, here comes the annoying prophet who says, nah, it's not going to wash, you know. He says, the reason given is that the Lord is not with Israel. And that means that fighting with these men on your side, it can only lead to trouble. God will not support your battle. In fact, God will oppose you. And there's a little bit of an ironic statement in verse 8, you know, if you go, be gone, you know, be strong in battle, but God will make you fall before the enemy. And the explicit statement, God has power to help and to overthrow. That's the underlying theme through all of this. It doesn't matter how many you've got on your side. It doesn't matter how well you've planned things out. Unfaithfulness is judged by God, and he can overthrow a great host. And nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or few, on the positive side. And so, amazingly enough, and this is an indication of the relative loyalty and tenderness of Amaziah toward the Lord at this early part of his kingdom, he doesn't flat out say, you know, to the guillotine for you. He doesn't reject the word right out. He asks a question. And in a sense, it's a very natural question, I suppose we could say. After all, I've got an investment here. Am I supposed to just throw my money away? That's the that's the point of this. What shall we do about the 100 talents which I've given to the troops of Israel? He's not about to ask for it back. You know, that's not the idea. What am I going to do? I've made this investment. Shouldn't we just go ahead? And again, this is what I had in mind in terms of the notable responses at the end of that verse, verse 9. The Lord is able to give you much more than this. It's one of those, you know, I think very common situations, not only in a corporate sense of what he has, how often rulers will say, well, we've committed ourselves to this path and we're going to go down it no matter what. And even individually, I think it's often the case that we say, well, I can't, you know, there's no turning back now. I can't depart from this path. And the word of the Lord is, oh, yes, you can. You know, it's not too late to turn from a wicked way. And the promise that's implicit in this is that God can bless you. God can restore what you foolishly have committed. And that's the encouragement that's given to him. It's really a positive word from God to encourage him to do the right thing. The Lord is able to give you much more than this. As Matthew Henry points out, just a couple of chapters later, his grandson receives exactly this amount of money, plus a bit more. And so Matthew Henry says he receives it back with interest. And that's, it's Jotham who's the king at that time. But the indication, of course, is whether he receives it back or not, the faithfulness that God calls for is always the best path. And to say that political expediency must be followed out, regardless of the consequences, is suicidal. It's a self-destructive sort of thing. So I like that saying, the Lord is able to give you much more than this. I think it's worth meditating on. Any comments or questions down to, I guess we're down to verse 9. That's not exactly a logical break, but comments?
One on 10, though. Why they got angry. And they got their pay and didn't have to do anything for it.
Yeah. Perhaps the best analogy is having the waitress get her pay, but not the tips. These people generally, I think, would make much more money from the spoils of war than they would from the payment. In fact, it's not clear how widely spread. If the 100 talents if they went to the upper echelons and not down to the rank and file or what. But there is an explanation, I think, besides the fact that they were just snubbed. I mean, they're ready to go. It's what, you don't think we're good enough to fight? Think you guys are better? That could have well been part of it.
That's what I would have thought would have played in there as well, is that because you're in a way, you're saying you northern guys are out of favor with God, so right, we're better than you are.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because the motivation of Amaziah is not really described. The superficial motivation is a military one. He wants some help. He doesn't have as many troops as he'd like. It could well be that he was seeking, as some of his fathers and some of his descendants would also do, to a rapprochement with the northern kingdom. You know, we want to get together again. We're not that different. And that false seeking of unity is implicitly rebuked here. God will bring about unity, but he brings it about in his own way, not this way. And I think that probably is part of their anger, is just that they're being treated this way. Yeah, so the anger that's described in verse 10 is their discharge. It just says their anger is greatly aroused, and they return home in great anger. Seem to get the idea that they're angry. And then that's, of course, brought up again later on in the chapter. Can I put my finger on the verse right away? Sorry, I've lost it here. It is referred to again, right, what they actually do. Yeah, verse 13. I was looking too far down in the chapter. It's just below there. So what they actually do is going to come up in just a minute here, but they were angry.
There could perhaps be some correlation to or some application to us or to me. I can see, or I want the help of these ungodly entities, I want to say, in order to succeed.
Right.
Says, you know, I have much more to give to them than this. And even, you know, in the church and things like that, there's forms of funding or, you know, things like that that you want to grab hold of.
I know what you're talking about. He's not talking about the church. He's talking about another agency. But go ahead.
But I don't know if we can pull application from there. Not that all those things are bad or evil, but that there's a certain faith that things will be provided from God and not from these places.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. It's really a question of where your hope and reliance are. They were specifically forbidden to make an alliance with the northern kingdom, but many times it comes to a matter of the heart and where it is. Who is able to give you more? Are they, or is the Lord? That's good.
Helen, I was just continuing with this thought of these guys being angry. I thought that same kind of anger is with Easter coming up next weekend. You get around other religious people and you imply that Easter has pagan origins to it and should be avoided. What you're saying is that something they've already sanctified and made holy is now unacceptable to God. And that same kind of anger shows up. I mean, we've all experienced relatives and that if we don't go along with that, with all the pomp and circumstances of Easter, there's usually an anger that, and I think it's a similar type root as this.
Yeah. One thing that I thought about in terms of just the way, sort of a worldviewish kind of thing, I guess, is there's this idea of progress, which is so important, and especially has been in the last century or so, and that you see this in C.S. Lewis. He likes to harp on this idea. You know, he talks about people who say you can't turn the clock back and so don't reverse progress. In one of the Narnia books, the king replies, "I've seen it in an egg. We call it going rotten." The idea is, you know, you can turn the clock back in the sense that you can turn back from a foolish way. And here I'm thinking in the bigger sense of the worldview commitment, which leads to destruction. It's not progress. If progress means people are taught to think of themselves as animals and to act then as animals. Progress is to repent of the foolish thought and to seek the right way. That may be getting a little bit far afield from the hired mercenaries, but it's that same attitude that we've already made the commitment, we can't go back from it, that it's really a kind of an arrogance against God. Okay, well, well, there's an interesting passage. Let's try to move on to the... I'll just touch briefly on the battle with in Edom. They're mentioned, described as the people of Seir. There's a first a defeat in battle, and then a large-scale destruction of apparently prisoners of war. It says the children of Judah took captive 10,000 alive and threw them over this cliff or off of this rock. There isn't any description of a provocation given here. It could just have been an act of tremendous cruelty. This is not unknown in the ancient world, or in the 20th century for that matter, that sort of cruelty. But I'd rather not get into a discussion of whether he was right or wrong, or because there's not much information given here. But what does follow after it is, first, the description in verse 13 of these men who raided. And there's some question about the description from Samaria to Beth Horon. Samaria, of course, would have been in the capital of the northern kingdom, and why they would be raiding there is not completely clear. But the it could be that some of them weren't actually prepared for battle, and when they received the word of the snub, that they started there and worked their way down into Judah. In any case, they took much spoil. But verse 14 starts the explicit... description of the explicit downfall of Amaziah. And it is that he brings the gods of the people of Seir, sets them up to be his gods, bows down before them and burns incense to them. Now, our immediate reaction is that this is an act of complete irrationality. Why would anyone do anything so stupid? And ultimately, I think that's correct, and I think you can even see that from the rebuke that it's given. The rebuke that it's given is basically in those terms. What in the world do you think you're doing? That's the paraphrased version of it. But that's, you know, that's the idea of how could you act this way? But let me try to fill in some of the mindset that would lead him to act that way. It is ultimately an abandonment of rationality in the sense that he's turning to idolatry. But it was a common practice in the ancient Near East and even the Romans did this sort of thing. Was when you conquered a nation, was to take their gods and add them to your pantheon, your collection of gods. Now, the idea was that the gods were the ones who were somehow the power brokers. They controlled whether you lost or won the battle. And so if you take their gods back, then you're really saying, well, you gave me the victory here. And thank you very much. That may be one reason why they would start to worship them more. Just an acknowledgement that their gods were now on my side, so I'll take them back and add them to my collection. So this sort of practice was not unknown, but it's still an irrational one, right? Because it's still saying that the Lord is not the true God, that the Lord couldn't have conquered the Edomites, that the Lord needed help from the gods of the Edomites. So it is ultimately just a complete abandonment of trust in the true God. And that's why the rebuke comes this way.
Don't you think, though, that it was... I think this is a warning to us that it was much more subtle. It was, in fact, that this was a sort of a tradition that was followed.
Exactly, yeah.
We just fall into these things without thinking. To us, this looks ludicrous because
right.
We don't do this. It's like, well, isn't he stupid? But all he was doing was doing what other people did.
Yeah.
To celebrate their victory. And he could have very well rationalized it. He was very... whatever.
Yeah.
And we do, I think we are inclined, because of the way our hearts sometimes turn to do similar things, just that they're much more comfortable to us than actually bowing down to an idol.
I think that's a good point. It looks very stupid, and I think ultimately it is stupid in the sense of the rebuke, but we don't look at our own actions as being that way, or I guess we would say, or we wouldn't do that, right? We wouldn't do something stupid, but except in retrospect, I think we see. I think that's a good point. It is a subtle sort of thing many times for us, and we don't realize how much we buy into. In this case, it's really a kind of a syncretism in the sense that he's adding these gods to his own religion. Yeah.
Is it also possible, perhaps, he grew up with
worship of Israel, you know, the worship of God. Maybe he had, you know, the head knowledge, but his heart wasn't really committed to God. And now he's gone out and seen this other religion and then have all the do's and don'ts and caters to the flesh and everything else. And that kind of happened in this country in the First World War. Selling these young folks off to Europe, and they saw all this stuff that didn't exist in this country and brought all that back, and it's caused all the living of the 20s.
I think that's right. I think there is an attractiveness to the flesh of these pagan religions, and that could have been a factor. None of this is really brought out explicitly here, but what is explicit is the rebuke in the verses that follow what we read. In verse 15, why have you sought the gods of the people who could not rescue them, your own people, from your hand? So that's the stupidity, I guess I've used that word before, that is the fact that, you know, these gods couldn't even rescue their own people. Why would you do something like that? And it's really assuming you believe in the one true God. Why would you do something like that? It's completely contrary to your professed faith. Now here his reaction is a serious indicator of the state of his heart. And the king responds to him, "Have we made you the king's counselor?" I suppose you could think of Ahab of old and the ones who were on his payroll who only gave him, you know, the right answers. And it's really saying, "I didn't ask for this. I'm not paying for this. I don't want this. Be quiet." And he says, "Why should you be killed?" Of course, that would remind everyone of what his father had done to Jehoiada's own son, to kill him. And the prophet doesn't, it says he ceased, but he adds one word. And this word, in a sense, structures the rest of the chapter. "I know that God has determined to destroy you because you have done this." This probably refers to the seeking of the gods of Edom, and have not heeded my advice. Now there's a kind of a play on words here that there's a one Hebrew root for the word in verse 15, "Why have you sought the gods of the people?" The word "sought" could be translated "consulted." And it is kind of amazing because this is the word that is used when men are commended for seeking the Lord. It implies a certain diligence. So whether he had to go out of his way to find these gods or not, it implies that he was determined to go after the gods of Edom to get them. And then when he says, "Are you the king's counselor?" So it's like he had consulted the gods of Edom, but he doesn't want to listen to this consultation. He doesn't want to listen to that fellow. And then at the end of verse 16, it says, "God has determined to kill you." That is, God has basically taken counsel to kill you. It's the same idea again. God has his own counsel, and it's not something that's good for you because you have not heeded my advice or counsel. And then in verse 17 again, the play on words comes on because it says Amaziah king of Judah asked advice or counsel. So you see again and again there's the idea that he's seeking counsel, but it's all the wrong kind of counsel, and the counsel that's provided for him, the explicit warning, is one he doesn't listen to. And in fact, the Lord has taken counsel to destroy him. So that, as I said, structures the rest of this, and it indicates, as you can see through other explicit references in the chapter, the underlying theme of the chronicler, and as I said probably the first week when we started this series, the underlying theme of much of biblical history, well, you could say all of the Bible, well, that is that God's plan is being worked out in history. Here is the case of God's plan being worked out in history as a plan of judgment on a man for his sins. And that statement then, as we read in verse 16, that God is determined to destroy you, is followed up on later on in the chapter, as I said. For example, in verse... I'm going to have to search again. Sorry. Verse 20. Yeah, I always keep looking farther down than I need to. Verse 20, Amaziah would not heed, for it came from God that he might give them into the hands of their enemies because they sought the gods of Edom. So So there again is the statement of destruction that God had determined to bring on them. And this is a very sobering fact for the sinner. The sinner will find God's hand of judgment against him, even if it's the hand of judgment which uses our own pride to bring the judgment about. You see, that's what's going on in the verses in between, the two references to God's sovereign determination. What is it that Amaziah does? Well, he's too big for his britches? I mean, he decides, if I've wiped out Edom, I can go after Israel as well. It may be that it was in retaliation for what the mercenaries had done. That's not made explicit. But in any case, he's got grand ideas. And in further irony, this is one case where the northern kingdom has a good word to say to the southern kingdom. Like, you better watch what you're doing, buddy, or you're going to get in big trouble. You don't want to pick a fight with me. And this is the chronicler's presentation of the fact that even though the northern kingdom is not to be given out, is not to be allied with, yet you should listen to reasonable words even from them. And so in verse 17, he says, he seeks advice, not very good one. He says he's going to, he asks the king of the northern kingdom, to Joash, to come to battle. And he gets this rebuke, a reply in the form of a parable. There's this little thistle and this great cedar, and the desire to have the daughter, the son to the wife, would refer to some sort of an alliance. And all it takes to get rid of a thistle is a wild beast to trample on it. And that sort of parable may sound familiar. There's something like that in the book of Judges, for example, a similar sort of rebuke to take a bit of heed of what your situation really is. And so in verse 19, it's made explicit. You've defeated the Edomites. You think you're powerful. But why should you meddle with trouble that you should fall, you and Judah with you? And Amaziah, it says, would not listen. That's a very sobering fact. It says he would not listen because God had determined to judge him for his sins. And it's again really an act of irrationality. He has no reason to do this. I think in the larger scale, he could have been angry about the mercenaries, but there's no reason why he should act this way. But he would not listen to a reasonable warning. That theme of pride leading to a downfall is shot through the Proverbs. If I tried to list the book of references in the book of Proverbs only just to this idea, you know, I'd fill up a large part of the board. Again and again, there's the idea that the foolish pride can only lead to destruction. In this case, as Jehoash of Israel says, not only in the personal sense, but also in the corporate sense, that even the nation would suffer. And so he doesn't listen, and they go out to battle. And that's the last part of the chapter. Any comments or questions before we actually turn to that last part? There are actually two more parts.
In verse 20 here, where it says, for it came from God that he might give them into the hands of their enemies because they sought the God of Edom. So you back up and say, oh, they sought the God of Edom. And because it's not explicitly, but it's because of sins earlier on. And then you say, well, those sins occurred because of something earlier. So you have this spiraling. Every time they commit a sin, then it brings on a judgment which causes a greater judgment, which causes a greater judgment.
Yeah.
And we all have that propensity to do that if it weren't for the grace of God.
That's right. And that, the but for the grace of God is a key thing here. This is eerily reminiscent of Romans chapter 1, where God gives them over, and he gives them over. As they fall into one sin, he gives them over to a greater and a more debasing sin. And it's only because of God's covenant faithfulness that he doesn't give his people over to what they would fall into already without his restraint. So that's a good point. In fact, that I'm jumping ahead to maybe the end of the passage, but as the king of the northern kingdom goes to this destruction, he could have lost everything. He could have killed this guy, and he could have put himself on the throne of David, even though he had no right to it. In other words, he had the power to do it, you might say militarily, from a natural point of view. It was only God's restraining hand, I think you can say, that kept him from doing that sort of thing, and that restrained him from acting in a more overwhelming way than he actually did. Yeah, the battle is described there, and apparently there wasn't really much of a battle. It says they fled. It said in verse 22, every man fled to his tent, which is a typical biblical language for a rout. There was not much resistance that the northern kingdom found. And what he does is capture the king, brings him down. This is very humiliating. The whole thing is very humiliating. Brings him down to this captured king's capital and just destroys much of their defenses and takes the spoil away, takes the gold and the articles along with hostages. It's even possible that he could have taken the king as hostage and that his son started to rule in his stead. That's not said explicitly, but it is interesting that it says in verse 25 that Amaziah lived 15 years after the death of Joash. So he outlived the one who had captured him, and it may be that he was actually released from captivity at that point. But in any case, he was terribly weakened militarily. And the reason is just because of his foolishness, because of his pride, his confidence that he could take on the northern kingdom. It was that blindness that he had been given over to. So the chapter ends then with the, as I mentioned at the very beginning, something that's very similar to what had happened to his own father. There was a conspiracy against him. The timing is given in verse 27 in the sense that it was apparently a long-running conspiracy, because it says after he's turned away from following the Lord, they made a conspiracy against him. So as in the last chapter, it was with dissatisfaction with the unfaithfulness of the king. Although the act in itself wasn't righteous, the conspiracy and the assassination, it was out of just being fed up with the foolish consequences of idolatry. It makes a nation miserable. They say, let's get rid of this guy. And so they conspire against him from the time he turns away. He flees to Lachish, is not really able to get away, and is killed and brought back and given a proper burial at the end of the chapter. And so then his son, who is a relatively good king, amazingly enough, considering what he saw in his father, starts to rule. His son has his own problems with pride, as we'll see. But that's the conclusion of the reign. Any comments or questions?
It's really quite sobering to see the whole country being given one direction or another, being lifted up or debased by the hand of God, the whole country. Well, it's one thing to think of it your own self, see your own sin, glad in the Savior, or see despicable people in history being passed over. It's I think, a different thing altogether to see whole nations guided in one direction, decimated or brought up. It's very, very sobering.
Yeah, and it's sobering considering the fact that it all has to do with the heart. Yeah, I think it's important that the chapter starts out that way. He wasn't wholehearted in his devotion. And the point that Lisa made about the subtlety comes into that, right? You miss the subtleties when your heart isn't devoted to the Lord. You're going to say, well, everyone else is doing it, or you don't even think about whether it's right or wrong, or where the Lord would have you to go. And it is a very sobering chapter, because it was exactly the opposite of what he sought for. Riches, conquering kingdoms, greatness. He lost it all. The whole thing is gone. This guy comes in, humiliates him before all of his people, takes away the spoil, takes some hostages, whether he's one of them or not, and he dies by assassination. It's just a mess. And that's not unique in Chronicles, but I think he wants us to be sobered. God does, by these things, to ask about our own hearts, and again, in our own sphere of authority, how it is we lead, whether we lead with that same attitude. Because it had very damaging consequences. Any other comments or questions?
Dave, what you commented, certainly in preparing to worship God, because except for the grace of God, we would all be descending down through sequences of consequences for the things we've done in our own personal lives, and the fact that God continues, because of his covenant, to redeem us, redeem circumstances, restore. Should cause our hearts to well up with worship.
Yeah. Yeah, looking at what could happen, except for the grace of God, should give us a great thankfulness for his grace. And to make us cast ourselves on him for his grace.